Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. We have three different stories this hour, and our first is about urgent care clinics, but not the kind that you go to for stitches. A new kind of clinic that's been popping up across Ohio and the country in the last couple of years, emergency mental health clinics. Joining us to explain what kind of services they offer and how you can find one nearby is Dr. Aaliyah Jones. She's the Executive Medical Director at Luminous Health Behavioral Health Urgent Walk-in Clinics. Welcome to All Sides, Doctor.
Hi, good morning, Anna. Thank you for having me.
So can you start by just explaining what a mental health urgent care clinic is?
Sure. So a mental health urgent care clinic is a place where someone can go if they don't have a relationship with the organization and they are having either a mental health crisis or they just need to get reconnected to behavioral health services and don't know how to negotiate or navigate the system.
So what kind of services are offered at these clinics?
So generally, there's a nursing assessment, and then you see a mental health clinician, whatever the level is of the provider at that location. And most of these clinics also will have a prescriber, whether that prescriber is a psychiatrist, physician, or a nurse practitioner who's able to prescribe medications if they're needed.
And are they, I know this may vary from clinic to clinic, but are they generally open like after hours, like a regular urgent care?
So I would say it depends upon the clinic. Yes. I think that most clinics start out operating traditional business hours. And then once the sustainability issues are addressed and the need and usability issues are addressed, then the hours can be expanded. Our clinic opens is open at traditional hours. However, we did receive some grant funding that's going to allow us to extend the hours into the evening in the next couple of months.
And it sounds like this is really a place for a multitude of issues. So it could be you've had an anxiety attack or a panic attack, and maybe it's the first one you've ever had and you're not really sure to go where to go. This is a place to get started.
Definitely. So if you have a pre-existing behavioral health condition, however, you're not connected to resources and you need someone, you can go. If your provider is out of town and you don't have a way of getting your medications refilled, that's a service that we provide at our location. If you are just feeling low and you don't know whether you have a mental health problem or not, maybe you just want to have somebody to talk to let you know, yes, this is something that you should look into, or I think that you're just managing a stressor and you're going to be fine, that would be a reason to go to an urgent care clinic as well. So I think there are various reasons. Probably the only reason to not go to a behavioral health urgent care clinic is if you acutely want to harm yourself. If you acutely want to harm yourself or harm someone else, then you need to be in a safer environment. And from that instance, you should go to the emergency room. But for everything else, an urgent care walk-in clinic is a really good fit. Most people who present to emergency departments don't end up needing to be admitted, only about 30%. So 3 out of 10 people who go to the ED actually needed to go to the ED. 7 out of those 10 people could have gone somewhere else. And that somewhere else, the ideal somewhere else would be an urgent care clinic.
And I do want to say that if you or a loved one are thinking of harming themselves or others or experiencing a true mental health crisis here in Ohio, you can always call the Mental Health Emergency Hotline 988. And Ohio's Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services has a crisis services dashboard where you can find services by your county at mah.ohio.gov. But you know, I think it's fascinating because it's not like a traditional urgent care. Where did this idea get started of like a separate urgent care clinic specifically for mental health?
So there are places that have been doing this for very many years. When I trained at the University of Maryland over 20 years ago, we had a psychiatric urgent care center, which was right next to the emergency department. And it was a way of getting people access to care who did not need to be in a secure environment, but were having a crisis and needed assistance. And I believe that as we have looked at the fact that navigating the behavioral health just navigating services is hard.
Healthcare in general is complicated.
It's very complicated. And people don't, if you're in a crisis and you need someone to talk to you, and to for someone to tell you that, in order to see a psychiatrist or in order to see a therapist, you have to wait 2, 3, 4 months, that's unreasonable. And so there has to be an alternative to that. And so, similar to how we have alternatives, if you're having an acute medical issue that's not an emergency, you have some place to go. If you have a cold, if you have a sniffles, if you hurt yourself, you don't need emergency room care, but you do need someone to talk to make sure that you're doing the right things or to start you on medications. It really is an equivalent model to that. And it's a long overdue expansion of this type of service.
It also, I assume, costs less than going to a traditional emergency room, much like an urgent care will be less expensive.
Definitely costs less, and you can get through it a whole lot faster. Most emergency room waits are tend to be fairly long. However, urgent care facilities, since they're only managing one type of patient, they usually can get you in and out within a couple of hours, say 1.5 to 2 at most.
And you said that there are often psychiatrists who can prescribe medication if somebody needs it, but these are not places to go for long-term care, right?
Generally not. So the idea is that it's a place to get plugged in. So you come in because you need direction, support, assistance with medications, crisis counseling or therapy. And then the care plan is coming up with what's the next step for you. And so usually that would involve a referral or a list of recommendations to other providers. However, we don't have a policy, and most places don't have a policy that says that you can't come back. So while you're waiting to get plugged in, you might go back to the urgent care facility. So, for example, you're not going to be able to get an appointment with a therapist for 3 or 4 weeks. Well, you could certainly go back to the urgent care clinic for, until you get connected to whatever that next step is. Fortunately for us, we have an outpatient mental health clinic that we operate as well. And so we refer a lot of people who come to the urgent care program to our outpatient mental health clinic for ongoing services. However, that would be for patients who are appropriate to receive services in our clinic, who have the conditions that we feel equipped to treat. And we don't treat everything, obviously. And so we definitely do refer people to other providers who specialize in things that we might not cover. And I would imagine that other urgent care facilities do the same.
And is it also like more traditional urgent cares where you might say, hey, we really can't treat this. You need to go to the ER?
We do have times where people come to us and they are acutely suicidal, or they're too agitated to get through an assessment, and we have to get them to an emergency department for the safety of the individual and for the safety of the team. So that definitely does happen, but that's more the exception than the rule.
So what kind of follow-up care do you provide after these visits?
So most people, again, are referred to our outpatient mental health clinic, and where they are connected to a long-term provider, someone who can see them for the next coming months to years. And then, or if someone is not appropriate, or meaning they have more acute needs, but they don't need to go into the emergency department or for an inpatient unit, they might need a day hospital treatment or an intensive outpatient program. So those are alternatives to inpatient hospitalization, where people live at home, however, come in for care for either all day long, Monday through Friday, or 3 days out of the week for about 3 hours. That's the difference between partial hospitalization versus intensive outpatient. So those are alternatives as well. So usually people will either go to outpatient therapy, outpatient medication management, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient, or they might get referred to a substance use provider if their problem is the substance use disorder. And that would be a referral to an outpatient clinic or even a referral for an intake at a residential drug treatment program. So all of those are possibilities, including others. So if you have someone who has an eating disorder, we would might refer them to an eating disorder specialist or If they're having problems with dementia, referring them to a geriatric psychiatrist. So there really is no limitation to the type of person that we can help in these environments. The only exception really would be is someone who's acutely harmful. And in that way, what we do is facilitate the transition to an inpatient unit through the emergency department.
So if somebody is thinking this might be a place that they need to go or they would want to know whether it's the right fit. So one of the interesting things we've talked about traditional urgent cares in the past, and you know, not everyone has an X-ray machine or not every one of them has a lab on site. So does it stand to reason that like not every mental health urgent care clinic has a psychiatrist or this or that? Like, how do we go about picking one if we think this is a service we need?
That's a really good question. You really, it probably would behoove you to look at the clinic before you get there, to do a search, online search, to find out what sort of supports or services do they provide, to find out if they do medication management. If they do medication management, there's a prescriber there, and whether that's a psychiatrist or whether that's a seasoned nurse practitioner, one or the other. At a minimum, they are all going to have mental health clinicians there to do crisis counseling. And I think it's probably a best practice that they have a prescriber available. However, that might not be something that's available to every single clinic.
Has there been any difficulty staffing professionals? I'm thinking of sort of the shortage in mental health professionals.
There's always a challenge with staffing. Yes. We're doing just fine. We have not had any challenges. As of late, I mean, when we have an opening that's available, we have a great recruitment team, and we have a great team and people who want to work for Luminous Health, who want to work in Prince George's County. So we've been successfully able to recruit talent when we've had openings. However, yes, that does remain a barrier, and I think that that's a barrier to expansion of a lot of clinics that want to go to 24 hours, finding staff who want to be work on site to do these services because it is an on-site service. We don't provide virtual services through our urgent program, though we do provide virtual in our outpatient mental health clinic, not for our urgent walk-in clinic. All those services are provided on site.
This might be too individualized of a question to answer in a broad way, but you know, what are we talking about in terms of cost to visit one of these clinics? Because, you know, mental health care tends to be one of those things that, you know, insurance companies cut or say your employer cuts before they cut your regular health care.
Yeah, so that is certainly something to be aware of. Fortunately, in the state of Maryland, even if you're uninsured, the state covers the cost of care for behavioral health services, depending upon the type of service. So this type of service would be covered under for people who don't have insurance in the state of Maryland. We don't turn anyone away from our urgent walk-in clinic. And you know, maybe that might not be make the best fiscal sense, but it is a commitment that the organization has made to the community. And so how these services are paid for will depend upon the state. Most states do have billing codes for crisis services. And the question is, are the rates, you know, I don't know, we're going to have that conversation, but you know, the rates generally for urgent care services are not, for crisis services, don't really cover the true cost of care for delivering crisis services because they just don't. So we certainly are appreciative of those who support our program through their philanthropic gifts. A lot of programs operate through philanthropy and or grants that help support the total cost of care for delivering these services. It is an underfunded and it's an underfunded service.
Final question. Do you guys take any extra steps, or how do you go about protecting yourself against, say, somebody who might, be feigning a mental health crisis in order to gain access to prescription medication? You know, I feel like, you know, do you ever worry about that as an issue, basically?
I think that that's certainly something that any prescriber would have to be aware of. We certainly do have limits to what it is that we prescribe. We will use the physician drug monitoring program to look at prescriptions that people have received to ensure that if they say that they were on a controlled medication, that they indeed were on one. When was it last prescribed? That's information that we would want. We generally don't do long-term prescriptions for controlled medications. If we prescribe a controlled medication in this setting at all, we generally tend not to prescribe controlled medications out of our urgent environment, just because the idea is if you're going to have someone on a controlled medication, you need to be able to follow that individual. There needs to be a continued relationship, and the nature of urgent care is not a continued relationship. And so you really wouldn't want to get into the habit of prescribing controlled medications in those types of settings.
That was Dr. Aaliyah Jones, the Executive Medical Director at the Luminous Health Behavioral Urgent Walk-in Clinic. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, Anna.
And just a reminder that if you are looking for a mental health care urgent clinic in your area, you can go online to the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. They have a crisis services dashboard where you can find services by county. It's at mha.ohio.gov. Coming up, Ozempic could have another side effect, pregnancy. We're talking about the women who say the weight loss drug helped them conceive. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Our second topic today is Ozempic and Wegovy, and how these weight loss drugs could have another unintended side effect, pregnancy. Women, even those with histories of infertility, have been anecdotally reporting their unplanned pregnancies while taking the drug, leaving researchers wondering why and whether these drugs could have an impact on their children. Amy Klein is a health and lifestyle reporter who recently wrote about this. She's also the author of The Trying Game, Get Through Fertility Treatment and Get Pregnant Without Losing Your Mind. Welcome to All Sides, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thanks for having me.
So women who use Ozempic and Wegovy and these other GLP-1 weight loss drugs are sharing their surprise pregnancies all over social media. There's even a Facebook group called I Got Pregnant on Ozempic. What's going on here?
You know, doctors are unsure, obviously, because it's too new, and pregnant women were excluded from the studies because they didn't want to, you know, anyone to get pregnant while doing all their studies. There are two things going on here. I think the main thing is that these GLP-1 medications not only help people lose weight, but it lowers your insulin resistance. And for a lot of women who are suffering from infertility or trying to get pregnant, a lot of them aren't even ovulating. And when you lower your insulin resistance and you lose weight, it kicks back in ovulation again. So people who had been trying, you know, I saw some people on Reddit who have been trying for 10, 15 years, all of a sudden after 6 months on the medicine found themselves pregnant.
So
that is the main thing, is if you have PCOS, you're obviously not ovulating a lot of the time. And if you're overweight, your insulin resistance is very high. You know, there are a lot of fertility clinics who don't let people over a certain BMI do fertility treatment because they say it's not going to work. So using these medicines seems to kickstart your body into either ovulating again or low insulin resistance, and it makes it easier to get pregnant.
There's also this other theory that I find really interesting, that perhaps the GLP-1, which are these glucagon-like peptides, I'm not sure I'm saying that correct, but they may be interacting with birth control.
Yeah, so there are some studies that birth control has adverse effects with certain antibiotics. Like if you're on a certain type of antibiotic, the doctor might say use a secondary form of birth control because we're not sure if you're trying to prevent pregnancy. And doctors aren't 100% sure, but they think the same mechanism that does delayed gastric emptying, you know, is preventing the birth control, the oral contraceptive from working. That's one of the theories, but of course it's not proven.
So what impact might this have on the baby that gets conceived on Ozempic? Because like you said, I mean, for obvious reasons, these drug manufacturers didn't include pregnant women in their trials.
Yeah, so women are women that I've seen online on different places, they are freaking out, you know, oh my God, I'm on Ozempic. So obviously you have to stop taking these right away. Some of the studies, Mounjaro, Ozempic, Wegovy found adverse effects in rats and monkeys, either miscarriage or limited growth to the baby, or some defects. But you have to remember that animal studies are not necessarily transferable to human studies. And these animals were on the medicines for their whole pregnancy. I have seen on social media, you know, some women who didn't find out till they were like 20 weeks pregnant and the baby's fine. But of course, that's always anecdotal. I think what doctors recommend, and, you know, reproductive endocrinologists like IVF doctors usually tell their patients to stop taking these meds 2 months before a transfer. And that's what the medical information says. But obviously, if you're on the medicine and you find yourself pregnant, you don't know how long you've been on it. So the information is so far anecdotal.
So essentially, if you're taking one of these drugs for weight loss or even for diabetes, I guess, but that's a whole other conversation and considerations for your health risks. But essentially, you want to come off this about 2 months before you start trying to conceive.
Right. And I get, you know, there's two groups of people. There are people who are trying not to get pregnant, and there are people who are trying to get pregnant. So for the people who are trying not to get pregnant, you know, make sure that you have a secondary form of birth control, because your oral contraceptive might not be working. And for the people who, you know, have been trying for years and have never even been on birth control because they want to get pregnant, they just should really, you know, be aware of their symptoms. Like a lot of the women that I saw, they said, oh, they were nauseous, but they thought they were nauseous from the medicine. And then, you know, it took them a few months later to realize they were nauseous because they were pregnant. So I think if you're trying to get pregnant, you should just be testing a lot and see if you're ovulating and see if you're pregnant so you could stop the medicine right away if you think that you might be pregnant.
Yeah, because one of the main side effects of, especially when you're getting used to like Wegovy or Mounjaro or any of these, is nausea, is upset stomach. Like that is one of the most common side effects that people report.
Right. So it's hard to know. It's hard to know what this is, especially for women who, you know, haven't had their period in years or have like a weird period. And for women who just have given up on the idea of getting pregnant, they're not going to even think, oh, this nausea is pregnancy. But, you know, a lot of them say, oh, well, I had breast tenderness and nausea and I was sleepy. So, you know, then you should be testing for pregnancy.
Are the drug manufacturers at all considering looking into or investigating this a little more in regards to pregnancy?
Yes. Interestingly, they have opened up a registry. So that means they want to study. I think it's Novo Nordisk, who makes Mounjaro and Ozempic, have opened up a study, and they just say, please, you know, if you found yourself pregnant while on one of our medicines, please let us know. Obviously, they're saying stop the medicine, but there are people who have been on the medicine, let's say, you know, found out 20 weeks. So they want all the people who are having babies or got pregnant and miscarried to, so it's kind of like a retrospective study that they can look back. You know, they can't ask pregnant women to go on the medicine, but if you are found yourself pregnant, you can sign in and sign up for the study.
Oh, so they're trying to sort of build a database of all the different women and the children that they eventually have to kind of see if there's any patterns in the data that they're collecting. Yeah.
You know, I saw some women, I think on Reddit, I thought someone were talking about miscarriage, but, you know, it's not, you know, someone posted that they were pregnant and then at 10 weeks they say they miscarried. But, you know, as myself, as someone who had 4 miscarriages, miscarriage is much more common than you think. So you can't say causality, you know, she could have miscarried anyway. But there is some, you know, some evidence of miscarriage in animals. It was rats or monkeys. But for the most people that I saw online, they reported no adverse effects, which is, of course, anecdotal.
Yeah, I believe it's, what is it, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 pregnancies ends in the first trimester. It's sad, but it's not uncommon, especially that early on in pregnancy.
Yeah. The truth is, with this medicine, I mean, there's 2 interesting things happening here. One is, one of the doctors that I spoke to, Dr. Stephanie Fine, who helps women lose weight, not with the medications, but she helps women lose weight for fertility. She said something like, you only need to lose 5 to 10% of your body weight. And that could be anyone from like 300 pounds to 200, you know. If you're having trouble conceiving, it shows like 5 to 10% of BMI can help you get pregnant. So that's just interesting to see how this works. But she also pointed out, you know, we don't know, not even for pregnant women, but we just, you know, it's helping a lot of people, but we don't know the long-term effects of any of these medicines.
Right, because Ozempic, which is the form for diabetes, right? Mounjaro is the kind for weight loss, and they're in slightly different concentrations. But these drugs have only been on the scene for a handful of years, both as for treatment for diabetes and for weight loss.
That's true. I would be interested. They might have some, I haven't looked into it for the diabetes people. You know, there must be people who have been using it for diabetes who have gotten pregnant as well. But I'm pretty sure, you know, the way clinics make you reduce your BMI, and there's a lot in the wellness world of, you know, especially for women with PCOS who don't have periods, who have insulin resistance, tinkering with it naturally or with medication can, if that's your issue, that can help you fertility-wise.
That's really fascinating. I didn't realize that there was a weight limit or a BMI limit to seeking certain fertility treatments. Can you kind of explain what that is?
It's controversial, you know, because of the fat acceptance movement, and it is controversial, but some doctors, you know, I think it's a problem with anesthesia.
Mm.
So you have to go through anesthesia to do an egg retrieval. And fertility clinics are often want to have the best success rates possible. And if you have high insulin, you might not be producing a lot of eggs. You know, just to backtrack a little bit for those people who don't know, because I'm so versed in it, I feel like everybody knows what IVF is, but IVF is the process where they... you know, a woman normally ovulates 1 or 2 eggs a month, and that's it. And then the sperm has to catch it and get you pregnant. And in IVF, they increase your hormone level so that you produce, you know, anywhere 10 to 15 eggs. Then they retrieve the eggs, they take the eggs out of you, and in the laboratory, they create embryos with your sperm. And then those embryos, they put them back, and then you have a more chance. It can increase your odds, you know, 10 times instead of one time a month, you have 10 shots from that way. But if you have hormonal imbalances, and it doesn't have to only be PCOS, but if you have a hormonal imbalances, these medications are not going to work as well. You know, you're not, you know, and also for someone like me, I was older, so I don't have a hormonal imbalance, but, you know, I started fertility treatment at 40. So I had lower chances. I was only producing one or two eggs a month. And then with the medication, I was only getting five or six, whereas a younger woman or a healthy woman would get like 10 or 15 eggs a month. So for IVF clinics, it's all about the odds. So I think it's twofold. The BMI limit is because of anesthesia dangers, because I think there is problems with anesthesia, and they want to increase your odds of, you know, creating more eggs. And if you have hormonal imbalances, you might have trouble doing that. So that's why they send some people away, or they ask them to lose a certain amount of weight. And that's why some people either go on these medications or go to experts who put them on, you know, fertility diets.
I want to circle back to the birth control thing, because you kept saying oral contraception. So does that mean that like IUDs and birth control injections won't be affected by the drugs?
No one really knows for sure, but the doctors that I spoke to were talking about oral, because, you know, that you have what is called delayed gastric emptying with these with these drugs. So that might change the absorption of oral contraceptives. I don't know about injection contraceptives, but I feel like something mechanical like an IUD wouldn't be affected by a pill, because it's, you know, like a physical barrier, not the absorption of a birth control medicine. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But it also sounds like these are definitely conversations you should be having with your primary care physician or even your gynecologist. So if you're on Ozempic, maybe it's a good time to have a conversation with them about what your plans are for growing or not growing your family going forward.
You know, it's true. One of the women that I interviewed for the article who had posted her original video on TikTok, she was an influencer, and she had been trying for a long time, and they kind of even gave up on trying. And then she found herself, 8 weeks when she realized that she was pregnant. And so she went off Ozempic, and she had to go on, I think, metformin to control her insulin. And after she had the baby and she breastfed, because it's also, women should not be breastfeeding while on these medications. It should be pointed out, that says it very clearly in the literature. You shouldn't be pregnant or breastfeeding, because you don't know, you know, what the baby's getting in the milk. But after this woman, her name is Deb, she stopped breastfeeding. She wanted to go back on Ozempic, but for her diabetes, and she couldn't get the Ozempic because there was a shortage, because so many people were getting it for weight loss. And she said that her period stopped once she wasn't on Ozempic anymore. So basically the Ozempic kicked back her ovulation. It kicked her to ovulate, and it made her have her period. And when she went off it and her insulin diabetes problems came back, she stopped ovulating again.
That was Dr. Aaliyah Jones, the executive... Nope, that is the wrong card. I apologize. That is Dr. Amy Klein, a health and lifestyle reporter who wrote The Trying Game. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, new research into why middle-aged Americans are finding themselves increasingly lonely. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesdays on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Our final topic is loneliness. The desire to connect with others is fundamental, but our attitudes towards socializing particularly here in America, have shifted since the COVID-19 pandemic. We're socializing less, and that's not good. New research suggests loneliness can negatively impact our health and that middle-aged Americans are especially vulnerable. Frank Infura is a psychology professor at Arizona State University. His research chronicles the challenges and opportunities facing middle-aged adults. Welcome to All Sides, Frank.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we talk about the impacts of loneliness, I think we should define it. How do you define being lonely?
Yeah, broadly speaking, how within our research, how we define it is individuals have this disconnection between our desired levels of connection and interaction with others, with our perceptions of what our actualities are, what our abilities to really interact with others.
So everyone has a different capacity for social interaction, right? Basically, what feels lonely to you might not feel lonely to me.
Right, exactly. I mean, we've all heard probably the term of being lonely in a crowded room. So it's really a perception of our connection with others, you know, the degree to which we feel companionship, are we feeling left out? So it's really a perception and kind of individualized.
And it could be different, right, depending on how social you are. So extroverts might feel it faster than, say, introverts, or is that not correct?
I can't particularly speak to that, but I mean, that could be one hypothesis is that, right, extroverts may need more connection, more engagement, whereas for those, I mean, for me, I would consider myself more of an introvert. I may need less connection and physical interaction with others to kind of sustain my needs when it comes to social connection.
Let's get to the research into middle-aged adults in particular. Why is this category of adults particularly vulnerable to loneliness?
That's a really great question. And really the research that has our interest in driving this research, my colleagues and I, is for one, middle-aged adults are typically understudied when it comes to looking at their developmental milestones and just developmental processes during this period of lifespan, which is generally speaking ages 40 to 65 plus or minus 5 years on either end. And they're really going through a lot during this time when it comes to changing intergenerational relationships. So the relationships that individuals have with their aging parents, but also their children as well, and how they're launching them into adulthood, but also potentially having to relaunch them into adulthood. And on top of this, facing various financial vulnerabilities as well, and labor market instability. So I think it's particularly for middle-aged adults today in the U.S., it can be a particularly volatile time.
And how is this affecting their overall health?
Well, what we're seeing is it's negatively impacting their health. So in some other papers that we've published on, we've shown that middle-aged adults today are reporting poor mental and physical health compared to earlier generations.
You know, I wonder if it's sometimes a problem of overscheduling, right? So a lot of adults in that range have kids who have after school activities, whether it's sports or theater or whatever they're into, right? So you have your job, you have all the after school activities, you have obligations possibly to a partner, to aging parents. I just, you know, it's one of those phases of life where you sort of feel like I'll sleep when I'm dead.
I mean, that's a really good point that you raise. And I mean, I agree. I think it's, you know, when is it that individuals are having time for themselves? Or, you know, in the book Bowling Alone, you know, people, you know, he argues about how these like natural kind of engagement that we previously had within the community or organizations, whether it be with church or other local groups. I mean, people are just not as engaged as they were before when it comes to community and other aspects of their network. And this could, without having that red, you know, immediate connection with others that just naturally happens, that could certainly be in play here.
Yeah, the book Bowling Alone, though, was published in the year 2000. So based on your research, are things getting better or worse?
Unfortunately, I would say things are getting worse based on the research that we've published on and future papers that we're writing. It's the outlook doesn't look good, unfortunately.
Yeah, we did a show a couple of weeks ago about the nuns, which are people who don't identify as any particular religion. So they're, you know, they're not Catholic, they're not Christian, they're not Jewish, they're none of the above. And one of the things we ended up talking a lot about was social connection, and that church had traditionally provided, or whatever religious service you attended, that regular attendance provided a lot of social interaction. And as the nuns increase, yeah, those connections decrease.
Right. And you may not, it doesn't have to be like, right, when you're interacting with others that you're just disclosing your life story and your life history, you know, just catching up with others, seeing how others are. I have two young kids, and whenever we have play dates with other parents, it's nice to that our children find friends of and their parents that we enjoy being around, because for us it's a nice release of just comparing notes of parenting, you know, what madness we're going through, what sickness is going through, daycare, just kind of to have a place that you can go to just vent and find emotional and informational support, you know, is paramount. And, you know, with the pandemic and having kids, we kind of lost some of that, but now we're slowly gaining it back, but it's certainly taking time.
Yeah, that the pandemic really made us weary, I think, of being around others. And for some of us, it made us afraid. And have you been able to parse the data yet on whether we're likely to be more lonely, more isolated, maybe is the better word, post-pandemic?
So there has been some research looking at how the pandemic has impacted feelings of loneliness. And we did see like a short-term spike in it. But I think some of the data that's come out recently has shown we're coming back to previous levels. But with the paper that we just published, we used data from 2002 up until the pandemic. So we were looking at pre-pandemic changes in loneliness across middle-aged adults. And, you know, these trends were emerging even before the pandemic. So the U.S. was showing, or today's middle-aged adults were showing higher levels of loneliness compared to their peers in Europe even before the pandemic.
Yeah, let's talk about what's going on across the pond. So do you have any theories on why Europeans are less lonely than Americans?
We do have some theories, and this is some research that we want to do in the future to kind of test some of these ideas that we have. I think, for one, it's just cultural norms of belonging and built-in community. So within the nations that we study, there's these more built-in support systems. And also we discuss the social safety nets absolutely differ between the nations that we examine. So just knowing that you have, you know, say if you lost your job, or, you know, if you're having kids, that you have kind of a safety net to fall back on, and certainly play a role in this case.
How big of a divide is it for those listeners who haven't read your research? Like, how much less lonely are Europeans?
That's a really great question in terms of quantifying it. You know, I can go the boring statistics route of whatever, you know, it's, you know, around half a standard deviation or more, but for us, it's a large enough effect where it kind of makes us sit back and be like, you know, what's going on here? It's not something that we could just simply ignore.
So it's statistically significant.
It's statistically significant and in the large range of effect size. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about social media, because 2000 to right before the pandemic takes us through the rise of Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, what we think of now as social media. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any indication that the invention of social media had an impact on loneliness?
I, for one, haven't seen any strong research or strong effects saying, oh, it's absolutely social media, because it's so challenging to hone in on. You know, everyone uses social media for so many different ways. You know, if you're using it for maybe being more involved with the community or knowing what's going on in your community, that can, you know, be a positive aspect. But if you're just, you know, scrolling through Instagram or Facebook and not really engaging, but just seeing, wow, everyone's life is so much better than mine, then that can certainly take a toll on your mental health.
Yeah, I think it's really in how you use it.
Absolutely.
You know, what I find fascinating is it's not just, you know, middle-aged Americans. Younger Americans are increasingly expressing feelings of loneliness. And sometimes I wonder from a statistical standpoint if younger, like as we get younger, generationally move down, people are also just more open to talking about their mental health struggles and more likely to report being lonely, if that makes sense.
No, I agree. I think there's certainly been a generational shift when it comes to people's abilities to seek out help and treatment. And for, you know, if people are going through a rough patch. But I think another side of it, and kind of the lens that we take, is looking at these historical changes or looking at these, what else is happening for these generations as they're living and what similarities and differences there are. And I think, again, not to be too negative, or just, I think the times that we're living in, particularly within the US, are very, you know, different when it comes to especially young adults. It's, you know, they're changing jobs more frequently or even having trouble securing long-term employment. You know, depending on where you live, the prospect of buying a home, like, forget about it, right? I mean, we live in Phoenix, and, you know, during the pandemic, people found out that Phoenix was a large city that was affordable, and that's no longer the case. So really, when we think of these ideals of development and growing up, especially within young adulthood, it's, you know, those dreams that people had within their minds, they may no longer be immediately achievable.
No, I think that's a really interesting point. I wonder, is there any historical data points, like as we became more mobile in the last, you know, 100 years, the last couple of generations, like we're less likely to live in the place where we were born. We're less likely to work in the same place for 30, 40 years. We bounce around not only from job to job, but like city to city.
Yeah. And when we, you know, within the U.S., residential mobility has, I think, remained stable, or if not declined, but compared to our European counterparts, we're definitely more mobile, particularly when we look at different levels of education. So people who attain more years of education are more likely to move and be farther from family. And if you're more likely to move for work, then obviously that's gonna, you won't be able to take the time to really embed yourself in the community. It's more fleeting. It's just, you're there for a couple of years. You're not really able to be engaged or get to know your neighbors or get a sense of the community, and then you just are up and gone and move somewhere else. So having that certainly contributes to having weaker social and community ties.
That's so interesting that Europeans do that less than we do. Is that one of your theories as to maybe why we're more lonely?
That could be another one. I mean, it's something that we argue or we discuss in the paper. And I think not being as embedded within the community and being more mobile could certainly be another working hypothesis that we could potentially test in the future.
That was Frank Inferna, a psychology professor at Arizona State University. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And that'll do it for this hour of Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. Thanks for listening to 89.7 NPR News.